dread to come. And when they do, it seems like we just fly through them. We're already well over halfway through the days of unleavened bread. And then will come Pentecost, the other two holy days, and then the Feast of Tabernacles. And it just seems to slide quickly from the days of unleavened bread to the Feast of Tabernacles. Well, as I said, we all know that we are in the days, in the midst of the days of unleavened bread. Or as I've jokingly said many times, the days of hardtack. These are the days that we look for whatever might be wrong as far as the leavened products that we have and get them out of our life, out of our home. We're told to take or put, usually we say put it out of our home. And even at times, the Bible says that we are to purge, not just casually, you know, work on it, but to actually purge this leaven out of our home, because it means or is symbolic of getting rid of the things in our life that's ruining our life and causing us difficulty in our life. It is a very wonderful holy day because it is a tremendous lesson. There are many people who don't quite grasp yet why all these things are happening in their life, bad things are happening, and they can't figure out how to get a better life. Well, that's the purpose of this holy day, to remind us that we are to purge the leaven out of our life. We are to purge the leaven out of our house. We are to get rid of those things. The question, though, is why the emphasis on putting leaven out, and why the emphasis on putting it out year after year after year after year? We are reminded of this. Some have been here 40, 50 years, and they are still working in the same way that they did before. They are working on purging certain things from their life so that their life can be better. And in that sense, this holy day is a very wonderful holy day because it teaches us how to improve our life. But why do we put it out and why do we purge it out? It sounds like it's an awful something that if we don't get rid of it. But leaven is just a physical product. There's nothing evil about leaven of and by itself. In fact, after the days of unleavened bread are over, I like to keep on eating some of those crackers, because they're so good that I just don't want to throw them away. So it isn't, leaven is not evil of itself, and leavened products are not evil of themselves, but the unleavened crackers, unleavened things are a lot better. What is there about leaven that God uses that product year after year after year after year to remind us of something? What is it about that? Why didn't God use sugar? Now, I know you know what sugar is, and I'm sure you use it quite often. In fact, sugar is one of the things that is probably needs to be purged out of our life more than it is, because it is causing so many troubles in people's lives. But God is using unleavened products to remind us of something to get rid of year after year after year. He didn't, as I said, use sugar. He didn't use milk. He didn't use salt. He didn't use flour. He used leaven. Why? Well, that would beg the question then, what is there in leaven? What is it that leaven does to bread? Well, I think we all know leaven causes bread to rise. That's why I call it the unleavened hard tack. It didn't rise any, it's just there. There's no rising of the product. Leaven causes flour and bread to rise. It causes bread to rise so that it's edible. It's kind of hard if it doesn't rise. And yet there's nothing wrong with it being flat. There's nothing wrong with it being risen. God uses it as a lifelong object lesson. Object lessons are very important. They can teach us a lot more when there's a particular object being used as a modifier for whatever it is that is the problem, and we have an object that makes it much, much more clear. And so God has given us the object of unleavened bread instead of the leaven, because leaven causes bread to rise. But what is so wrong with bread rising? Well, nothing of itself. It's an object lesson. It is to teach us something, and it is used as that object lesson every year, year after year after year. And it's very interesting that the days of unleavened bread start not exactly immediately, but very, very shortly after we've accepted the sacrifice of Christ. The days of unleavened bread are put way down next to the holy days, the Feast of Tabernacles. The days of unleavened bread are put almost immediately after our acceptance of Jesus Christ as our Savior and the Passover itself. We take it usually very quickly after the Passover. Then we have the night to be remembered, and then come the days of unleavened bread. So it's tied in there very closely for a specific reason. There's nothing wrong with bread, nothing wrong with unleavened, with leavened bread, nothing wrong with unleavened bread from God's perspective. It's another object that He has created, but it is not so good for Christians, and it is an object lesson to tell us why. Let's look at the first Passover and the first days of unleavened bread with, as we call them sometimes, ancient Israel. Ancient Israel, who were or were to become God's people. I think we forget sometimes that God chose Israel for a specific reason. He was the friend of, and Abraham was the friend of God, and Abraham obeyed God. Abraham became the father of the faithful, and God promised to him that He would take care of his descendants, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, whose name was changed to Israel, and of course the many people who were Israelites. God didn't do that for the other nations, Gentiles as some call them. So we know that God chose Israel as His people, and He gave to them, not the rest of the world, the Passover and the days of unleavened bread. And this incident that I want to bring up now is after the Passover and after they're baking the unleavened bread. Let's notice in Exodus 14, verse 8, that the first thing that's brought up is a mindset, something that is indicative of their mindset. Exodus 14, and this is very important, Exodus 14 and verse 8. It's a little different word in the New King James language. The Old King James Bible has a specific word that we used many years. We still use it, and it still means the same. In Exodus 14, well, we'll see in verse 4, I will harden Pharaoh's heart. The king of Egypt realized that the Israelites were going to get away and they wouldn't get any money from them or any service from them. And so he made his chariots. He was going to chase after them and he was going to destroy them. And it says God hardened the heart of Pharaoh and he pursued the children of Israel. And notice the next statement. We've read this many years, and it sometimes gets old when, as far as the Old King James language, it says the children of Israel went out of Egypt with a high hand. A high hand. The New King James says it went out with boldness or confidence. The word that is used is still the same. The word in Hebrew is still the same, but it seems to have a little bit different meaning here, boldness or high-handedness. Obviously, Israel, having been slaves, didn't come out all that confidently, and they had seen what God had done to them. They realized He did it for them. They realized they had been blessed. And in that sense, that Pharaoh was punished and was hurt, and they weren't, that kind of went to their head, and they left with a high hand. The word for high hand is two words in the Hebrew. The word high means, it's a primitive root, and it means to highly, to be high, actively to rise or raise. Literally, it means to bring up, exalt self, extol, give, go up, haughty, heave up, make up, not on your face, but made up, you know, false, presumptuously, promote, take away, and the last meaning of it is to breed worms. I don't know why that's in there, but it is. And then the word for hand, high hand, in the Old King James, it's a primitive word, and it means a hand, literally. It can also mean, it's different from the closed hand, but the high hand. In a great variety of applications, literally and figuratively, and that's how God uses it for us. It can also mean presumptuously. It can mean sore. It can be drawn with strength, stroke, swear, terror, and a lot of other things, but primarily it is meaning a high hand that is presumptuously in that sense. Israel left with a high hand, or they left boldly. In other words, we're getting out of here. Everybody else is going to suffer because God is taking care of us and He's not taking care of them. As I said, God chose Israel as His people. He gave them the Passover, the days of unleavened bread. He intervened so that they could leave slavery and they could go to a place that was like milk, honey and milk, or milk and honey, a promised land. And Israel left with boldness or with a high hand. Well, I don't see how they could have left with much confidence, having been slaves for hundreds of years, not of faith, because they didn't really even know who God was for a long time. But there was a certain mental approach that they had, which is important for us today if we're going to be Christians. It's simply called a high hand. And because of that, because their mind status was high-handedness many times, they fell on their faces flat many, many times because of that mental approach, the high-handed approach. Now you may say, well, we're talking about the Old Testament here. They didn't have God's Spirit, so what could we expect? We're in the Old Testament. We go by the New. That's true, we do. So let's go to the New Testament and take a look at the teaching of Jesus at the Sermon on the Mount. We've read that a few times recently. But Matthew chapter 5, you will find that Jesus gave to His followers something that would make an individual a better Christian than they would if they left it alone. Notice the first thing that Jesus gave to people. He said, blessed are the poor in spirit. Now, being poor in spirit does not mean no personality, no spirit, effete, crushed. It doesn't mean that at all. A person who is poor in spirit can be very strong, very forceful, very dynamic, and still be poor in spirit. What did Jesus mean when he said, poor in spirit? Well, this is in contrast to what the Old Testament said that Israel was doing. Israel was always talking about rising up, rising up, rising up. Leavened bread produces this rise-up attitude, or unleavened bread is the opposite of that. We have to keep remembering what leaven does to the product of bread. It causes it to rise up, to rise up, and to rise up. So if the one who is poor in spirit has personality, good strength, he is not a poverty-stricken individual as such, there is a particular mindset that he or she has, and it does not say, hey, look at me. They don't have this, I'm going to rise up and take over type of attitude. It is a humane and very godly type attitude. Let's notice in Ephesians 2, beginning in verse 2, the contrast to this. This being poor in spirit, and thereby their having poor in spirit, they will be in the kingdom of God. Well, obviously, what we're going to read about in Ephesians 2 and verse 2 is quite in contrast to those who are in the kingdom of God. Ephesians chapter, where are we, Galatians? Ephesians chapter 2. These thin pages have always given me difficulty. Here we are. Ephesians chapter 2 and verse 2 says, Paul speaking to Ephesus, and he loved the Ephesians. They loved him. They honored each other. They dealt kindly with each other. They were the only ones, I believe, to give assistance to Paul. And he never forgot that. And he always honored them, even in talking to them in some of these epistles. He had been talking about God filling us, filling all in all. And then he said to them, you, the Ephesians, so church members, he, God, had made alive. So if he made them alive, it must have been that they had sins also. They had ruined their lives in some ways. You, he made alive, who were dead because of trespasses and sins. Now, I don't know that we realize that about ourselves or pay attention to that sometimes, but the reason we have had problems in life is because of breaking laws. There are living laws, whether we believe in them or not, they will influence our life for good or for bad. Living laws, and the breaking of certain laws is a sin. The keeping of certain laws is righteousness. And so he said, you he made alive, you who were dead because of what you trespassed and because of what you broke or what you sinned in. And then he said, in which you once walked according to the course of this world. He admitted you weren't always perfect. You didn't always live what was right. But when you changed, you didn't walk that way anymore. It says, you walked according to the course of this world, according to the prince of the power of the air. Now that sounds like strange language. There's a prince, and he has power in the air. A particular being who uses the air for his causing people to have difficulties. The spirit, or spirit being, who now works in the people who don't obey God's laws. That makes it even easier. If we are obeying God's laws, he doesn't have much influence on us. But if we're not obeying God's law, it is very easy to cause us more and more difficulties because we're not following the right guidelines. We're not living by the living laws. And he said, among whom also we all once conducted ourselves in the lust of life. Definition of lust in one degree is you want something and you just can't have it. You're itching to have it, but you know you shouldn't. So he said, we all once conducted ourselves in the lust of the flesh, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and the mind, and were just naturally people of wrath, just like all other people. So he wanted them to know that that was the way their life was before they came to God and his ways of life and to God's laws. But he also mentioned that there was this prince of the power of the air who was able to influence and does influence people through what we call an invisible wavelength. Have you ever seen the devil? Has he ever come up to you and talked to you? Then how do you know you've ever been influenced by him? If you didn't see him, you didn't hear him, and he never talked with you, then how could he ever influence you? Subliminal thought patterns that come into our mind. And we've often said, where did that come from? Where did I get that thought? Everything starts with a thought, and it is talking here about the prince of the power of the air, then he uses that through an invisible way. Have you ever thought about why we have one that is called the prince of the power of the air? What it was that caused the being who was once Lucifer to become Satan, the prince of the power of the air? What was it? Did God just, he didn't like him, he didn't want him, and he just got rid of him and made him be that way? What was it about Lucifer, who was called the light, son of light? What was it about him that he is so evil now and is so disastrous to those who aren't living by the proper laws? Well, it has to do with leavened and unleavened bread. That's why God has unleavened bread. It's teaching us something year after year after year so that we don't make the same mistake, because it is very easy to make the same mistake that Lucifer made and ruin, maybe sometimes forever, the life we could have had because we become bitter. And I mean bitter. Let's look in Isaiah 14 and verse 4 and later in Ezekiel 28, and we'll get some good information here about this prince of the power of the air and the subliminal way in which wavelengths through the air do enter our mind. They do cause us to listen to certain things. They do cause us to have difficulties that we wouldn't have otherwise, and why God asks us year after year after year to purge out the leaven and to replace it with unleavened bread or God's laws. Isaiah chapter 14, and we'll start in verse 4. It is speaking about the kingdom of Babylon. So one say, well, why are you using that about Lucifer or the devil? We'll get to that. Isaiah 14 and verse 4. Speaking to Isaiah, he said, take up this proverb against the king of Babylon. So we're talking about, God is talking about, an obvious physical being, the kingdom of the king of Babylon, who was a powerful being. His word was law in Babylon, and he could be a psychopath if he wanted to. It didn't bother him if people got killed for nothing, as long as he has maintained his wealth. So here's what they were to say to the king of Babylon. How the oppressor has ceased, the golden city ceased. Now we know that the Persians took care of Babylon and destroyed them. It said, the Lord has broken the staff of the wicked, the scepter of the rulers. He who struck the people in wrath with a continual stroke, he who ruled the nations in anger, is persecuted and no one hinders. The whole world now, earth, is at rest and quiet. They break forth into singing. And in verse 9, continuing to talk about this king who had tremendous power, the king of Babylon, hell from beneath is excited about you. We're going to get him finally. To meet you at your coming, it stirs up the dead for you. All the chief ones of the earth it has raised up from their thrones, the kings of the nation, and they all speak and say to you, have you also become as weak as we? You're not as great as you thought you were. And then notice verse 11. Now we're talking about a physical king, the king of Babylon, but you will find some things in the next few verses that are spoken to that man that cannot possibly mean he was talking completely and totally to a physical man. God does use people sometimes as a type of other things. Verse 11, speaking to the king of Babylon, who did have this quality, and the one who he is likened unto certainly had it, your pomp. You say, well, what's pomp? Well, have you ever said to anybody, you pompous idiot? Or you pompous jackass? Why do you think you're so great? Your pomp is brought down to Sheol. In other words, you lose it ultimately when you die. And the sound of your stringed instruments, the maggot is spread under you and worms cover you. What an ignominious end to a once powerful human being who was the law. No questions asked. And if you didn't follow it, off with your head. He died too. Then verse 12, it switches, it's still talking to or about the kingdom of Babylon, but it switches to another name. And what it says about this other name cannot possibly mean a physical human being. How you are fallen from heaven, O Lucifer. So there was a being named Lucifer. He was in heaven. He was the chief of the angels. But somehow he lost it all. Son of morning. He was a great light bringer. He had a tremendously wonderful job. How you are cut down to the ground, you who weakened the nations. Well, Babylon did, but this one has weakened even more. And not just for a short period of time, but for thousands of years. You have said in your heart, and remember, out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. And sooner or later, what we have in our heart is spoken externally. And sooner or later, we will do what we have in our heart. You have said in your heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne. So this being had a throne, but he wasn't. Babylon wasn't able to take it to heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. Well, Babylon couldn't do that. I will sit on the mount of the congregation on the farthest sides of the north where God's throne is. I will ascend above the heights of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. A better translation would be, I'm going to be the Most High. In other words, he wanted to be in God's place. Why did he want that? Well, I'll give you a little bit and then we'll go on. He felt he had been dissed and he was bitter, totally bitter. The unpardonable sin, because he never intended to change his mind, because he thought God had mistreated him when he found out that people, human beings, little bitty things from up heaven's way, we're going to be made spirit beings and be in the family of God forever. And he, Lucifer, was not. That angered him. And he hated God for it. And he hated the people that God created. And he hated God's plan. It said, you'll be brought down to Sheol, to the lowest depths of the pit. So, there is one called the Prince of the Power of the Air. He works invisibly, because if he came up to you and may say, hi, I'm the devil, and I'm here to kill you. I'm the devil, I'm here to deceive you. I'm the devil, I'm going to make you do the wrong thing so that God will get rid of you. We'd say, get out of here and stop bothering me. But if it's a subliminal thought that's coming into your mind, and the thought lingers in the mind, and we give ourselves to the mind, who knows what we might do? Because we don't see anything, it's just something that's in our mind. Let's go then to Ezekiel 28, and we'll start in verse 14, where again I say, this is talking to the king of Tyre, another nation state, you might say. And what is said to that being could never be said exclusively to human beings only. Ezekiel 28 and verse 4. Well, let's start first, though, in verse 2. Son of man, say to the prince of Tyre, thus says God, because your heart is lifted up, and that's what the meaning of leaven, or the what leaven does to bread, it causes it to rise or to lift up. Dilly and I were watching, just a little time out here, a couple of Sunday mornings ago, I think, on the program of Charles Osgood, and he has an awful lot of good things to say. He was giving us the history of matzos. I don't know that I'd ever heard it, but it was interesting. And there is a famous brand of matzos in New York City, about 100 years old or so, a street brand. It's family business in New York City, and as I said, it's 100 plus years old. Grandpa had it, father had it, now the kids have it, and if they die, when they die, the others. It is a national product. They mix flour and water dough, rolled out in sheets, and they have huge equipment pieces doing all this. Then they run it through a machine that perforates that thin bread. Why do they perforate it? So that none of it will rise up. And, you know, you don't have to do that in order to have matzos. But they do that to cut the possibility that down that they won't have air bubbles there that will destroy the good stuff in the matzos. Interesting one. As I said, Osgood has some really good programs on Sunday mornings. Anyway, back to Ezekiel 28, we're talking about the Prince of Tyre. He said, because your heart is lifted up, and you say, I'm a god. I sit in the seat of gods, in the midst of the seas. The audacity of an individual to say, I'm already God. I sit in the seats of God. Then it is said to be said to that being, though you set your heart as the heart of God, there's no secret can be hidden. With your wisdom, you've gained riches by your great wisdom. And then in verse 6, therefore this is the Lord God. And after reading down here into Therefore, in verse 6, therefore thus says the Lord God, because you have set your heart as the heart of a god, here's what's going to happen. I'm going to bring strangers against you, the most terrible of nations, and they'll draw their swords. In other words, they were going to lose their life. Verse 9, will you say before him who slays you, I'm a god, you can't do that. But you'll be a man and not a god. in the hand of those who slay you. You will die the death of the uncircumcised by the hands of the aliens. For I have spoken, says the Lord God. And then in verse 12 it said, take up a lamentation for the king of Tyre and say to him, thus says the Lord God. Now here are those words that no human being could be like this. You were the seal of perfection, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Well, I don't think the Garden of Eden was still available for him in the days of that man physically. So here he's using another object lesson, speaking of a particular spirit being, and yet using a human being as a type of that, because the human being had certain qualities and characteristics that fit in perfectly to this spirit being that was being discussed. You were in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was your covering, and it lists quite a few of them. It says, the workmanship of your timbrels and pipes was prepared for you on the day you were created. Didn't say born, but created. You were the anointed cherub who covers. I established you, and you were on the holy mountain of God. You walked back and forth in the midst of fiery stones. Now, I know there are some who teach that you can learn to walk in hot coals and not burn your feet. That's been going on for a long time. Tony Robbins, who's a multimillionaire, uses that in his program. And most of them have done it. A few of them have burned their feet, and he's been sued because of it, but he's still doing it. But it said, you walked back and forth in the midst of fiery stones. You were perfect in your ways from the day you were created. And then he adds an addendum to all of that. He said, you were perfect until lawlessness was found in you. This being who had been in the Garden of Eden, he deliberately tried to deceive and ruin Adam and Eve. He deliberately hates God. He deliberately wants to destroy the church. But he doesn't want you to know who it is and what he's doing, because you can't see him. He says in verse 16, by the abundance of your trading, you became filled with violence and you sinned. Therefore, I cast you as a profane thing out of the mountain of God, and I will destroy you, covering cherub, from the midst of the firing stones. He will never have a place in New Jerusalem. So, he is able to influence mankind with this wavelength, this specific mindset or attitude of mind. And this has been the story of humanity from the very beginning with the Garden of Eden. The words are, rise up, rise up, rise up, in society and in the church. There are those who feel they've been bypassed. They're angry, hostile, bitter about it, and they want to get even. They want to take advantage of other people. And quite often it is they want a higher position than what they've been given. That was Lucifer's problem. He had a wonderful job, but he wanted more, and when he didn't get it, he became terribly bitter. So his ploy is to destroy all those people who will be in the family of God. So let's look back in Ephesians 2, beginning in verse 2 again, and see just a little bit about this after seeing it in Isaiah and Ezekiel. Ephesians chapter 2, and starting at the beginning, Ephesians chapter 2, verse 1 said, you, and these were church members who were now wonderful people, they were honest and honorable, they were generous, they loved the Apostle Paul, they helped him wherever they could, they were, as we say, good people, good Christians. And he said, he, God, made you alive. Even though they were good now and wonderful people, generous people, there were times in their past life when they really weren't. And he said, you were dead in your trespasses and sins, in which you once walked according to the course of this world. You lived according to or by the principles of and fell prey to the principles of this prince of the power of the air, this spirit being who now works in the sons of disobedience or people who aren't obeying God. If you don't obey God's laws, you don't really have anything to deal with. You don't have anything to protect yourself with there. And God is not going to intervene in your life either. And he said, among whom also we all, so Paul included himself, we conducted ourselves in the lusts, fulfilling the desires of the flesh and the mind, and we were just naturally children of wrath, just like everybody else. Then he talks about God being rich in mercy of his great love that he loved us. This being who was typified by the king of Babylon and the king of Tyre, that being that was typified is certainly not that full of mercy and wanting everyone to have the best. He wants to secretly fill our minds with, you got dissed. Rise up. Take advantage of it. Do your thing. Get rid of those people. Whatever it takes, do it. You deserve more than that. Rise up. Rise up. God says, eat unleavened bread. And remember what it means and why we're asked to do it and how wonderful it is. Now you may say, I thought we were told to grow, to improve, and to be the best. To strive to do all within our power to do. To strive for excellence if possible. It sounds like it's contradictory the way you're putting it. Not so. It is right and good to grow, to improve, because it says those who overcome, which is nothing but spiritual growth, will inherit the earth. There is a difference between striving for excellence and doing it to grow and be like God than in striving to take advantage of others because you have come to the point that you're able to do that. You say, well, then what's the problem? Well, the problem is one word, emphasis. Where do we put our emphasis and whom do we emphasize? Do we put it on ourselves or on others and our work? Is the emphasis, like it says in the Bible, that you treat others as more worthy of your own self in certain things, the emphasis often is rise up, or in modern English, hey, look at me. Look at me. I got it. People sometimes think of Christianity as a lackluster way of life because you've got to give up everything and deny yourself of everything and be poor. Let's notice in Luke 9, verse 23, where that is kind of talked about. And many times people who know a lot about the Bible do not fully grasp this verse or what its true meaning is. And or like the young man that said, well, I'd like to follow you, but I got a couple of million here and I'm not about to give it up to follow you. And he left. And the apostles noticed what happened in Luke 9 and verse 23. You will find Jesus, again, the words of Jesus, and he put it this way. Luke 9 verse 23 says, well, let's see. Verse 20 is an important one because Jesus didn't say this until they had committed themselves to what they believed about him. He said, well, I don't care what others say. I want to know what you think. What do you think about me? Who do you think that I am? And Peter said, the Messiah. The Messiah of God. And he said, well, you're right. But you don't yet realize this Messiah is going to lose his life. He'll be killed and raised a third. And so then in verse 23, he said, if anyone desires or wants to come after me, that is to follow Jesus, to be a Christian, if anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself. And that's where, by misreading it, many people feel that Christianity is just to deny you everything, no good things, no enjoyment of life, no money, no. Let him deny himself. There were some old individuals in pagan religions that they would sit there and they didn't work, they didn't make any money, they denied themselves. They had to have everybody else take care of them. But this deny himself ties right in with the days of unleavened bread and the days of eating bread that is good for us. Let's reread this. If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself. And the thoughts and things that plague us, that are in us, deny ourselves. Self meaning our nature, our problems, difficulties. Now, others, they deny it by saying, no, I'm not that way. I'm not that way at all. And they're in denial that they are that way. But he means, look at what you are, look at what you've done, look at your qualities and characteristics, or as Paul said, check up on yourself. Look at, get to know yourself. And get rid of those things that are killing you. And then it said, take up his cross daily, and follow me. So, in Luke 4, verse 9, is an example of how Jesus dealt with one who was trying to entice him to give it all up. In Luke 4 and verse 6. Luke 4 and verse 6. This is where Jesus, this being who knew who Jesus was, who hated Jesus, who hated the Father, who hated what they believed and were trying to do, who hated human beings. If he, this being, could destroy the leader, that's all he needed to do. So he came to Jesus trying to get rid of him because he was God in the flesh of a human being. It was possible he could make some mistakes if he could be enticed properly. Luke 4 and verse 6 says, if I can find Luke 4 and verse 6, I won't read the whole thing. It's about where Satan came to Jesus and said, you're hungry. Why don't you just command this stone to become bread and there won't be any problem anymore. Jesus answered him accurately from the Bible. And in verse 6, the devil said, look, I know you are the Messiah. I know you'd like to rule all the world. You're doing it for that. He said, well, in verse 7, he took him to the high mountain, showed him all the kingdoms, and then he said to Jesus, it was meant to be an enticement, all this authority I will give you and their glory, because it's been delivered to me, and I give it to whomever I wish. Which should give us a little bit of an inclination against some of the people in this world and what they do and what's motivating them. But then in verse 7 he said, there's only one difficulty. If you will worship before me, then you can have that. And that's when Jesus said, get out of here. You must be stupid. I've already got all that. I just have to wait for it. And that's the case with all of us. And that's what unleavened bread and leavened bread teach us of. It's as if it's already ours and will be ours if we wait and we don't mess up. If we live by the living laws and we get rid of the sin, which is the breaking of the laws in our life, it is ours. We just may need to wait a while, and then we'll have it with no guilt at all. I won't say no problems at all, but it will be ours. In Revelation 21, verse 7, it says that he who overcomes will inherit all things. So that's growth. The one who grows and changes, follows the laws, he's going to be there and he will have it. He may have to wait a while, but that's life. There are a lot of things we have to wait for, but it's worth waiting. Leaven causes bread to rise. And of course, God uses leaven every year to remind us of Lucifer's mistake and his effort to influence us. So the days of unleavened bread are as a result of God using an object, leaven, to show us what shouldn't be done and to show us how to become more like him. This has not been something that is a one-time thing. This has been an ongoing thing in history and of individuals paying the consequences in the world and, unfortunately, in the Church of God also, and, unfortunately, even in the ministry of God, causing difficulties because they listened to this and they wanted to rise up. Let's look at one at least in Numbers 16 and verse 1. Numbers 16 and verse 1. A very interesting one that has a parallel that we all lived through not all that long ago in one sense. Numbers 16 and verse 1. That's a good place to start. Numbers 16 and verse 1. Korah, Dathan, and Abiram, and those sons of Reuben took men or gathered people. They rose up before Moses with some of the children of Israel, 250 leaders. Now, it wasn't 250 ne'er-do-wells. It wasn't 250 individuals who just wanted to whine and complain. It was 250 leaders of the organization, representatives of the church, men of renown. They were in the higher echelon of government. They gathered themselves together against Moses and Aaron and said, you take too much upon yourself, for the church is holy too, every one of them. And the Lord is among them too. So why do you exalt yourself above the assembly of the Lord? You take too much on your own self. And they didn't like that. But why would they say that? Well, Moses realized what it was. They wanted to be in his place. And verse 8, Moses said to Korah, listen, sons of Levi, they already had a top job. Is it a small thing to you that the God of Israel has separated you from the church of Israel to bring you near to himself, to do the work of the tabernacle, to stand before the church, to serve them, that he has brought you near to himself, you and all your brethren, the sons of Levi, and... Now notice, here's the key. 250 famous ones, leaders in the organization, well-known individuals. They had a top job already, and it says, you are seeking the priesthood also. They thought Moses would never allow them to do such and such. Therefore, you and all your company are gathered together against the Lord. And what is Aaron? Then he said that, as Moses was talking to them. They wanted to take the lead. They wanted to be in the top dog position. And so the way to do that was to speak evil of Moses and get rid of him. But it didn't work because God was involved in the case at that particular time. You will find ministers are the targets quite often, and it is even listed in the Bible, and we have to beware of certain things that we don't, in our mind, decide to rise up, take over, take over. Maybe we haven't eaten enough of unleavened bread yet. Maybe there needs to be a little bit more eating of the unleavened bread. One more in Matthew 6, the first four verses, we experience this all the time. Matthew chapter 6, it's kind of funny. But it isn't funny because it's real. Matthew 6 and verse 1 says, take heed that you don't do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, if that's what you're trying to get, that's all you're going to get. He said, don't sound a trumpet. Now, it would be strange if every time we had the Holy Day offering service and the men, the deacons or others helping would be bring the box along or the little thing along and get your money. And as you were reaching out to give it to them, they had a little trumpet, and he blows that trumpet to remind you that I gave that. He said, that's all you're going to get. A charitable thing. I've noticed also, and I do it too. I did it the last time. I donated something to the church for the offering of the Holy Day. When they bring it along, you know, on the little green envelope, it has your name. It has how much you're giving. And it's, you could hold it out and make sure it's there long enough that everybody could see it. Or you could do what most of us do. We flip it over. So that nobody knows who it was that gave this. And that's the way it should be. But this rise up says, hey, look at me, what I did. You'll never believe that I did it. Sports is used from time to time in the Bible, applying it to Christianity. Running, boxing, sports figures, they're all right there in the open, and it's for all to see. Some of the humorous things you see, and we do laugh at it, but it ties directly into what Jesus is talking about being, shall we say, the perfect Christian, and not doing things just to be seen and ogled over by other people. Some of the things that are done to give the impression, that we should be honored more. Hey, look at me. Have you ever noticed that quite often when a man playing basketball slam dunks the ball, he hangs onto the rim? Now, why does he need to? So that people can see who it was that did that. Quite often when they dunk over another player, they do that deliberately to intimidate. Others, in another sport, when they catch the ball and run into the end zone, they do the little jig in the end zone so that people can notice. And quite often it is, hey, look at me, look at what I'm doing. They're getting a show, and that's all they'll get. Of course, today they get a little money too, but Phil Jackson, the leader of the Chicago Bulls, that won, was it three or six different medals, you might say, winners of certain things in basketball, professional basketball. He wasn't anything special as far as a coach and a man is concerned, but he did have this one ability. He knew how to mold a team. And Michael Jordan was the greatest player he had had to mold. And Michael could make 40, 50, 60 points in a game. And in that sense, unless the others were scoring, he really didn't need more than one other player, and he would be the main team. So Phil Jackson persuaded Jordan that if he would pass the ball, they could win more games. If he wouldn't try to be the only one, if he would bring the others in, who were also talented, but if Jordan never got rid of the ball, they had no chance. So he finally did convince Michael Jordan that this truly would be a good thing. And they won, and they won, and they won, and they won. Because it is true that if it's just there for yourself, it may or may not work. I have a past history of nothing like, I didn't dunk the ball, but I mean, as far as this principle is concerned, of allowing the game to be played properly. Some years ago, maybe 20 or so years ago, I was trained in refereeing basketball by a long, long time veteran basketball referee. And he was a good one. Now, one of the things he cautioned me against was grandstanding while you're playing, while you're refereeing basketball. And you know what? Foul! And make a big deal over the fact that you called a foul. And I listened to what he said, and I tried to follow that. Grandstanding is making a show of calling the game. The game is the game, not the referee. A good referee is not even really noticed that much if he's doing his job the way he ought to be doing it. But when he starts putting emphasis on himself and not the game, you realize this is a grandstander. And he has a problem. So he taught me a lesson. Unleavened bread is a wonderful product. There's no sin in leavened bread. And in a sense, there is no righteousness in unleavened bread. It's just a physical product that God is using to teach us a lesson about how to become like God. And we do it every year, every year, every year. Shortly after the Passover, picturing the death of Jesus Christ for all of humanity. They remind us every year, year after year. And so I'll say as closing, the next time you bite into a very, very delicious piece of unleavened bread, think about its meaning. It will not tell you, rise up, rise up, rise up.